Live from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful, sunny California. Thanks for tuning into the Water Zone Show today. It's a great day today, but it's going to rain Friday.
Saturday. Sunday.
And here's my wonderful co-host, Mr. Chris Davies.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm splendid, man. Thank you very much for asking.
I know. And he's brought us something today?
I hope I'm not bringing you the cold and
the neurovirus.
Neurovirus earlier in the week.
No, you're better though, right?
Yeah, okay. I'm much better. Thanks very much.
Good. Because that season's going around right now.
Yeah, and it's a hard hitting little virus as well.
You were praying to a throne.
I certainly was in multiple languages.
It's bad. You know, it's really bad when you're sick.
Yeah, kidding.
It's just not a fun thing. I think I missed, I was telling you today, I missed one day being sick in the last 14 years I've been here.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's pretty good. So I came here, I was sick as a dog. Could have stayed home, but I came. Anyway, we're here. It's a great week. A lot of good things happening. We have a new governor.
We do.
As of yesterday.
Gavin Newsom.
And we're going to be hearing some things from our wonderful Miss Chris Austin from Maven's Notebook and some of the new things. So we want to welcome her because we don't want to.
We've missed you, Chris.
Yeah, we don't want to do all the rapping. How was Disneyland?
Oh, Disneyland was wonderful. It's just a treasured experience every year. We try and take my kids. I mean, you know, you take your kids when they're young, and it is such a difficult thing. I mean, you know, it's a mixed bag because they have so much fun, but then they get overstimulated and they scream and they cry, and you know, it's just this managing young people through there. But when you go back with your teenagers, it is way more fun. And
they don't mind standing in line now.
Oh no, they don't. And you know, the best thing is that I don't allow them to take headphones, and they don't take headphones. So you know what we do when we stand in line is we talk.
That's awesome, yeah.
How many opportunities do you get to have your kids where they're your teenagers, where they're sort of like a captive audience, and there's nothing else to do, so their lips start flapping. I find out all kinds of things, but you know it's great. It's you know some of the best experiences, the best memories of my life with my kids will be those days we spend at Disneyland.
Wow, when I heard you were going to go, Chris, I told Rob, I said, hey, oh man, I have some like A, B, C, and D tickets that I can give to her, right? I've used up all the E tickets because they were the best rides. And then Rob said, they don't use those anymore.
Oh, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, now they have this app on your phone where you can order up your Fast Pass tickets. And Fast Pass tickets are like a ticket where you get to go in a much shorter line and get on the ride faster. Then you get those, but they sort of, you know, give you, like you get one set and then you have to wait an hour and 45 minutes before you can order the next. But now that it used to be when it wasn't on the app, you had to go over to that area somewhere next to the ride, get your ticket, and then come back. Now you do it on your cell phone, way more faster and way more efficient.
I have a way to beat that. You bring your cell phone, have your kids bring their cell phones, and then each one of you separately.
Oh, no, it's smarter than that. Disneyland's got this down. And you got your ticket, your scan, and your picture and all that. But I have to tell you, you know, we use that app, and I had to pay $10 more per ticket, but we went on every ride we wanted to go on, a couple rides twice, and we got to the end of the night, and they shoot off this massive fireworks display, and then they spray fake snow on you, and and they play this really sweet Christmas song. I can't remember what it is, but it was just like a melt your heart moment.
Magical.
And it really was. Disney's really great at that.
They're first class. Disney's first class, and I do got to say for the joke I made about Disney, we are an approved supplier to Disney, so we really do like them, and they do so professional on all their shows, no matter what it is.
Oh, it's a class act, no doubt. I mean, you go to Disneyland, and there's, I don't know how many tens of thousands of people they move through there, but you never see the grit of it all. You know, how much food they must serve, but you don't see them, you know, carting down, you know, cases of food down the streets.
No.
You know, it's all, the magic is all there, and that's their whole thing. It's all about putting on a show. And so, you know, I would say, especially over the Christmas time, it's not as crowded as you might think. But don't tell anybody that, okay? That's just between us three, okay? But anyways, it was great. And boy, you get recycled water at Disneyland, and that's great, too. So, you know, heads up to the Orange County Water District.
Absolutely.
But that's not why we're supposed to be here talking.
No, but they use a lot of water, and they do a lot of, they're very big on water conservation. I know the things that we do out in Orlando, everything. They're very crucial about how they display and use their water there. Because, I mean, Disneyland here at night, when I used to work years ago at Altec Lansing, did all the audio stuff for them, at midnight when they closed, they used to hose down the streets. They don't do a lot of that anymore. I mean, they clean them, but it's in a different methodology. So, anyway, speaking of water, and last week we did have some rain, but since we're going to have big rain this weekend, what is going to happen to the snowpacks?
Oh, well, hopefully it's going to put some nice snow up there. We're hoping for a good year. You never know. It's still too early to tell. I mean, it really takes till March before you know. We've had these nice wet falls, and then it just stops and dries up, and hopefully it won't. And there's some storms coming in. Oh, it's a big atmospheric river, it looks like. The thing about the atmospheric rivers is they tend to be warmer storms,
mm-hmm.
So that means they tend to not dump as much snow, and sometimes they rain on the snowpack, which melts it. So, you know, it's really the storms that come down from Alaska. However, you know, these are the type of storms that, as a state, we have to start getting better at, you know, capturing them. But it's a different type of storm than what our infrastructure is set up for. Our infrastructure is set up for, you know, the snowstorm that dumps feet of snow in the mountains that melts slowly over the spring and the summer. And we all count, and you know, here's the water that you count on. These atmospheric rivers tend to come in and they dump a large amount of rain, and you have to be able to capture that flow before it just heads out down to sea. And it's difficult because capturing large amounts of water is not an easy thing, especially in a you know, state that's, you know, highly developed. You need space for that. You know? So, but, you know, those are the things, you know, with the stormwater projects that are in place, and, you know, some other things that are going on across the state are looking to address that.
Yeah.
So.
I hear that Arizona's now, they have to identify their next bucket of water because they think California's taking too much out of their thing and they want some desal plants.
Well, yeah, they're looking for some solutions. You know, there's this drought contingency plan that they've been trying to put together on the Colorado River. And the Colorado River is now seven states plus the federal government. And so six out of those seven states, including California, have all approved now this drought contingency plan, which basically involves states agreeing to leave water in Lake Mead so that Lake Mead doesn't drop below a certain level, because if it drops below a certain level, it won't be able to generate hydropower out of Hoover Dam. You hit Deadpool, you can't get any water out of it, so it's a big concern. And so the drought contingency plan is sort of an agreement that all, theoretically, seven states are going to leave some amount of water and prepare for drought on the Colorado River. But Arizona has really had a hard time buying into this agreement. And they have some farmers there in Arizona. I mean, Arizona takes water from, I think it's Lake Havasu, and they ship it all the way off to Phoenix and where and way into Arizona. And in Pinal County, they count on that water to do their agriculture. And, you know, Arizona's got to figure out how are they going to do with less. And so it's been difficult in Arizona for them to get it together. And they haven't yet approved the drought contingency plan for their state. But every other state has, that's six. And Brenda Berman, the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, gave yep. Arizona till the end of the month, January 31st, to approve this plan. Don't know if they're going to make it. Mm. But to add on to that, Metropolitan Water District actually has 500,000 acre feet, possibly even as much as 620,000 acre feet in Lake Mead. And so they said this month, Jeff Keitlinger said, if there's no approval on this drought contingency plan, then we're going to start taking our water from Lake Mead, because we're not going to, you know, that's a 500,000 acre feet or more of water, and we're not going to let that go. So Metropolitan has started to move their water out of Lake Mead, which then makes it difficult for everybody else, because they don't want Lake Mead to fall below that level, but Arizona has to get on board. So, you know, we're all waiting to see what happens with Arizona. And part of what's complicating matters is the shutdown, because the Bureau of Reclamation is a party to this agreement, and their lawyers are not at work because of the shutdown. And we have this deadline looming, and so it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yep.
Well, sooner or later, they're going to have to get, somebody's going to have to shift, right, and make a decision. Otherwise, we'll have a shutdown in the state of Arizona.
Well, you know, the hard part is that there's the water is just not there.
Right.
And the bad year that we had a few years ago with no snow in the mountains was sort of the year that Colorado had last year. And they're not getting much better this year. I mean, it's so now their snowpack has dropped below normal at this time of year. We're, you know, where they started off good, but now they're drifting down. And, you know, I mean, the chances are it's not going to be a good year for the Colorado River. And climate model projections are that that's the way it's going to be in the future. So, you know, the states that rely on the Colorado River need to figure out how they're going to deal with this.
Why can't they build a tunnel for water from the East Coast to the West Coast? They have pipelines for oil, right? Right?
Yeah, but you know, I think that the times of transferring water from, you know, areas, you know, that and crossing the country, I don't think that's going to happen, because that pipeline has to cross other places and other states, and you don't get a lot of cooperation generally. And, you know, I think it's kind of like your budget. I mean, we need to start learning to live, you know, somewhat within our means,
right.
what is really reasonable. And I think what's reasonable is the water that comes to these systems that we have, and we need to adjust to that. But I think to, you know, think about far away water coming to us is it's really expensive and probably not feasible. You know, they had this big plan in Canada to replumb Canada, you know, because they got lots of snow and lots of water, and send it all over the United States, as far south as Arizona, and it was, I can't remember what it was called, but the, like the Northern American Water and Power or something like that. I mean, it was a huge system, and there are still people out there that are proposing such a thing. I just think that these big projects and transferring water from one area long distance to another, that era is done.
Yeah, that Canadian plan was back. Yeah, I remember hearing about that back in the 1970s, Chris. I mean, that was way back then.
And oh yeah.
It's just the environmental impact and the cost of doing it back then was, you know, one tenth of or less of what it is today. So you can imagine what it would be like today trying to attempt something like that.
Well, I assume if it's the same kind of problems we have with the single or twin tunnels we're talking about here and how long that's going on, it'll still never be built in the next 30 to 40 years distribution all over the country.
You're right. I think, Chris, you hit it on the head, right? I mean, with the type of weather that we're getting today, these days in this decade and probably next, the source water is coming from a warmer source. It's not being kept as much throughout the year in the form of snowpack at the higher elevations. It's coming faster and needs to be collected more readily than waiting for it to melt slowly.
Right, and that's really where the most cost-effective and our best chances are, you know, for collecting the water. We need to kind of adjust our system and adjust the way, you know, we deal with things. And it's going to be hard because, you know, there's a lot of water rights on these rivers that really are set in time, you know, like at a certain time you can pull, you know, be it April, you know, 2nd to May 1st, and I'm just making that up, but that's your permit from the State Water Board says those are the times you can pull water from the river. And if the snow melts earlier or there's not enough snow and the big flush comes down a month earlier and then you go and it's your turn to turn on your pumps and there's no water there, I mean, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of, you know, hard changes we're going to have to make in our water rights system and our water allocation system, because it's going to be coming in a different way and in a different schedule than what we're used to.
Yeah. Well, what's this? I hear the Recharge Roundtable call to action. That's going to start helping out?
Well, you know, the big with groundwater management, sustainable groundwater management in the Central Valley, that's pretty tough because researchers have identified like a 2 million acre foot structural deficit, they term, which means that the Central Valley is pulling out 2 million acre feet, which is a lot, more than what's being naturally recharged. And sustainable groundwater management, which is now the law, means that they have to find a way to cut back. And so the big discussion now in the Central Valley is recharging the groundwater aquifers and how can we do a better job of taking these big rainfall precipitation events that are going to come in and finding a way to sink them into the aquifers. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of hope for this. And there certainly is a lot that can be done, you know, by capturing these large flows. But it's not going to make up the 2 million acre feet.
No, it's just a lot of water.
It's a lot of water, but there's great hope in recharge. And so, you know, but there's things that the state needs to do and there's changes that we need to make. It's all about, you know, kind of rethinking our water system in a way that's going to adapt to the changing climate that we have, which is kind of undeniable.
Right.
California.
We've seen the climate change effect on weather patterns and the rain that we get. So there is some variability in how much water is hydrologically available, right, every year. So the state really is looking at what's the best way to manage, to collect and store that water. I mean, that's the basis of what their challenge is, right?
Yeah, and, you know, and it takes some rethinking of things, and it's going to take some money to change the infrastructure because, you know, there are some improvements that need to be made, and that's going to mean, you know, pouring concrete, and that, you know, construction projects are expensive. And I think there's ways that California can adapt. Climate models actually seem to be showing that, you know, Northern California, the amount of precipitation isn't going to necessarily change, but the form in which it comes, meaning less snow and more rain. So, you know, we're not now the Southwest, of which Los Angeles is part of, is being, you know, shown to, you know, dry out farther. So we won't, we may not necessarily get as much local rain as we have been getting in the past, which hasn't been much. But Northern California is still, you know, precipitation-wise is looking pretty good. So, you know, we have the infrastructure in California to deal with this. So, you know, I think that we're not looking bad. Sea level rise will be probably more of an impact, but we also have to be looking at changing our water system to capture these larger rain events when they occur.
Right. Absolutely. Chris, any other questions?
No, I'd love to talk about a whole bunch of stuff, especially that great Pacific garbage patch and the fact that that machine that went out there has had a little hiccup and is on its way back for repairs. There's a lot of good stuff in the news this week. For those of you who haven't yet checked out Maven's Notebook, an absolutely fantastic place to go.
It is the encyclopedia for daily news of water, and you can also go there and be a sponsor if you like, and we suggest you do that. We get all our news pretty exclusively from Miss Maven Notebooks, and we love it, and we love Chris. So, Chris, we will talk to you, actually, not next week. Next week we have a training session all about central irrigation controllers. That's for the Irrigation Association, so anybody who's part of that organization can listen and or watch us live and get CEU credits for that.
That's right. That's next week.
Next week. So, Chris, welcome back. I'm glad you had fun at Disneyland. And I get to see the fireworks every night from my house. So
lucky you.
Yeah, I'm up on a hill, so it's pretty cool. But anyway, that's all I have. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to bring in somebody who knows about reclamation of water, a gentleman from Chicago.
Yeah.
And, so we'll be back in a minute.
Right. Chris, have a great evening, Chris.
Good evening, guys.
All right. So stick around. We'll be back. And I guess 2 minutes.
Knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. for new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
All right, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone. We're having a great time here, and all the way from the Windy City, the world's famous Chicago pizza and Chicago dogs, we have a gentleman coming up here, and his name is
Thomas Gunetz.
Thank you. See, Chris, got to be right on it. And he is the Assistant Director of Monitoring and Research for the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago, and he's also the President of the Water Environment Federation. So he knows a lot about the stuff we were just talking about with water reclamation and stuff, so we'd like to welcome him to the show.
Yeah, can we call you Tom?
Sure, you can call me Tom.
Okay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can we call you anything else?
Don't call me late for supper.
Okay.
Yeah. Rob and I won't tell you what we answer to at home, though.
That's right. Yeah, FCC will put us in jail. So thank you very much for joining us. We do appreciate that, and it's nice to have people from across the country and learning about things in different in territories. But I just got a couple questions. So how did you select your career? What was your career path, and how did you decide to get into this world of water?
You know, Bob, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I spent a lot of weekends hiking, backpacking, and camping up in the Appalachian Mountains, and it just really felt you know, close to and loved being around the water, the mountain streams coming down there in the Pennsylvania Mountains, and camping next to them, and just I was really drawn to water. So when it's time to look for field of study, when I went to college, I said, you know, this environmental engineering looks like it's something interesting to me, because it's the engineering part of things, which is problem solving, and then it deals with the environment. I specialized in water and wastewater treatment, and really loved that, because it also, as a field, it brings in the three basic forms of science. There's the physics, there's chemistry, and there's biology in there.
Right.
And so that's why I found that really interesting. And so that's why I got my degree in environmental engineering from Penn State University, and then went on to get a master's degree in water resources engineering from Villanova University. And I've been working in the field ever since for over 30 years now.
Wow. How long have you been with Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Chicago? I mean, has that been a bulk of your career? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that has been. I've been working there for 27 years now.
All right. And the MWRD, if we can short it to an FLA, also known as a four-letter acronym. So it's one of the older...
W-O-W.
Yeah. One of the oldest water districts, right? I mean, established in the late 1800s? I think.
Yeah, 1889, as a matter of fact. 130 years now that the Water Reclamation District's been in existence.
And right now, the facilities, the amount of equipment that you operate, can you kind of give us a, you know, a real roundhouse kind of 30,000 view look at what MWRD
these guys are
looks
big.
Like from a, yeah, just so our listeners can compare, you know, to, I mean, we've got listeners from big cities, especially here in California, but also, you know, small little water agencies around the country.
Sure. So we'll just give you a sense of scale in terms of population. So we handle the wastewater flow coming from 5.5 million people. So that's the city of Chicago, mm-hmm. plus 128 surrounding municipalities. So about 5.5 million people, plus the equivalent of about another 4.5 million people in terms of industrial flow and commercial flow. So about the equivalent of about 10 million people in terms of the flow we get. Now, in terms of size of our facilities, for folks who know the sizes of treatment plants, we treat about 1.3 billion gallons a day. And we do that in 7 water reclamation facilities. One of them, which is one of the largest wastewater treatment plants in the world, our Stickney treatment plant, which is designed to handle 1,200 million gallons a day, or 1.2 billion gallons a day of flow.
That's amazing.
It is impressive. I mean, you know, it was sort of a loaded question, I know, Tom, but you know, Rob and I knowing a little bit about the size of the operation there, great description of how it is. And it's there's tunnels, there's other collection devices and or facilities around the state also that that.
How many miles of tunnels?
We have 109 miles of tunnels. Now, the tunnel that you're talking about is it's a system that we call our Tunnel and Reservoir Plan, or TARP. There's another one of your, what do you call it, four?
FLAs.
The FLAs. There you go, TARP. So it's Tunnel and Reservoir Plan, and what this has done is it's for pollution control and flood control, and it's a deep tunnel system. So these are tunnels that are beneath the city of Chicago and the surrounding areas, about 150 feet down to 300 feet deep below the city, and it collects overflow. We have these combined sewers because it's an older city, so our rainwater collects into the same sewer system as the domestic sewage.
Mm-hmm.
So that combines together, and the way the system was designed in the old days was when it rained too hard and the sewers couldn't handle it, it just overflowed into the rivers, and that's just the way they did it. Well, it said starting in the 1960s, saying, you know, we're not going to accept that anymore because that is raw pollution going into the waterways. Now, it's very dilute, but nevertheless, that is, you know, untreated wastewater, so we can't deal with that. So we came up with the system, and the idea was to capture that first flush of the rain in a deep tunnel system. So we have 109 miles of these tunnels up to about 33-foot diameter. It's a really massive system that collects during rain systems, it rain flows, it collects that, and then we hold it in the tunnel until the rain stops, then pump it out.
Does it fill that whole thing up?
Oh, yeah. It will fill the tunnel up on a good cloud burst.
Wow.
In fact, it filled it up so much that that tunnel itself was not enough to hold some of the larger rainstorms. So to add to that, this is where the reservoir part, or the R part of the TARP system comes in. And we have three reservoirs around the county which hold up to 10 billion gallons of flow. So when the tunnel fills up, then it backs up into a reservoir. So you just imagine it's like a big hole in the ground, like a giant bathtub that fills up, and then that holds it. Now, when the rain stops, we send all of that to the treatment plant. It's all treated, gets full treatment before it's discharged to the waterway.
That's just amazing. Just the sheer numbers and the size is unbelievable.
Yeah, it is very amazing. These reservoirs are actually rock quarries. They're limestone rock quarries. So we mine the rock out of there, which is used for construction. So it's a kind of a win-win. The contractors get the rock, we get the hole in the ground. And to be at the bottom of one of these things and look up about 400 feet deep and just look to the top, it's amazingly deep, these giant rock quarries. In fact, Michael Bay even came out to Chicago and shot some background materials for one of his Transformer movies inside the reservoir there.
Oh,
it was
wow,
so cool.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you got a couple of fans in this room for that run. So, you know, we've heard a little bit about the production and municipal side of your business. Kind of let us know what's your customer base. How many meters do you service? I guess that's the way that some of us in the water business look at that. What's the geographically and numbers wise?
So we actually, our agency does not do drinking water. And we do solely the wastewater treatment and stormwater management. So we don't count ourselves in terms of meters, like you would consider meter connections for drinking water. So since the wastewater comes to us from the municipalities, we don't do a local collection system. That's why I look at it in terms of population. I say that we have 5.5 million people, real population. And it's a service area of about 880 square miles. To give you a sense geographically.
Yeah.
Do you do, Tom, do you do any outreach at all or education or some way to get to the customer, the advent of water conservation or better use of water?
Well, yeah, we sure do. We have really good public information office. We have email blasts. One of our best forms of outreach is to go into the schools. It's the young people, they really absorb this information. And then they go back and they talk to their parents about it. And they say, hey, do you know what happens when you flush the toilet? Well, let me tell you. And, you know, you shouldn't be putting that kind of stuff down into the toilet, because we were taught that it just ends up making a big mess. So you shouldn't do that. So the kids are really a great part of our outreach. So we go into the schools. We also love to give tours. And I know sometimes the kids will come and they're like, oh, it's sewage plant. You know, oh, what are we here for? But once they start seeing the stuff in action, they really get excited. And they say, so this is what happens when I flush the toilet. And it goes from here to there and through this machinery. That's really some of our best outreach.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Majority of the people in the United States have no clue to what happens with water and what they do with it and all that. And it's just amazing to go through a plant and see all these things and learn about that. I understand that you guys partner up with the Department of Energy's Argonne National Lab, and they were doing a study regarding the Chicago area waterway systems. What was that about?
So that's really a fascinating study. It's a seven-year study, and what they're doing is they call it the metagenomics study. So it's everything now is meta, right? Everything's meta these days. It's really big. It's taking a look at the DNA of all the organisms that out of the Chicago waterway system, because throughout the season, the microbiology is going to change there. And what we can do now is start to understand where the different sources are coming from if there's pollution going on. So in the past, what was happening is, like, we go to our lake or go to the river and you take a sample and test it for a bacteria we call fecal coliform. And that's like an indicator bacteria. If that's present, then it says there's a good chance then some pathogenic and harmful bacteria are also present. Mm-hmm. That's why you call the word fecal, same thing as the word feces.
Yep.
But that's not, it's not accurate in, is it coming from humans?
And the acronym is POO.
There you go.
Sorry.
Yeah. So is it human POO or is it seagull POO and so on? And that is important to know the source. So now we're able to identify with the DNA. So if it turns out, and this does happen, you have dogs on the beach or you have a large Canadian geese population or seagulls, and these things get washed into the waterway. And so it's able to identify, is the problem human? Because if it's human caused, then we know where to go, start saying, okay, we got a problem here at the treatment plant. But if it's not, then we say, oh, now we're getting runoff from somewhere. So that's why it's so important to understand the source and also understand, see how it changes throughout the season and also in the depth. What does the population look like in the water? What does it look like in the sediment?
Does someone take an analysis like almost like on a daily basis or a couple times a day to see? Because that would affect what you do to treat the water.
Yeah, so exactly. And so we're constantly analyzing the discharge coming from our treatment plants, and we have continuous monitoring in the waterways themselves for various parameters. So we have a lot of data on things like dissolved oxygen, temperature, and flow velocity, and so on. So then the folks at Argonne are also taking their samples for the various micro constituents.
Wow. Interesting. We could do a whole bunch. Let's talk a little, if we can shift over to your work at the Water Environment Federation. And for our listeners, if you can kind of give a short description on what that organization is and does.
Sure. The Water Environment Federation, or this acronym is WEF, WEF. So that's just the three-letter acronym there.
That's a TLA.
TLA.
TMI. Too much information.
Hey, I grew up near TMI. So that was Three Mile Island. So what the Water Environment Federation is, we're an association for water professionals, and we provide education, knowledge exchange, networking for 35,000 members of water professionals, primarily in North America, but also globally. What we do is we have publications, we have training manuals, and we also put on the world's largest conference dedicated towards water, and that's what we call WEFTEC.
Mm-hmm. And you do this in your spare time.
Yeah, my sparse time, yeah. No, that's true. It's a voluntary thing, but I love it. I get to work with people from around the country, some really, really top-notch, great people, and it's just very invigorating and inspiring to work at that level.
So what are some of the priorities and missions that you do and what you're going to do for 2019?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. So one of the most important things about is developing the next generation of the water industry workforce, because that's the issue of getting people to work in the industry is one thing. We're looking at increasing recovery of resource recovery in the water field, and also about water infrastructure funding, because you probably well know that the infrastructure in this country really needs the boosting to get up to just even normal working conditions.
Right. I guess it's kind of hard. I've done some. We collaborate with the AWWA out here, and they're one of the people who support the show here. I went to some of their educational conferences and things, and I was amazed how many people really starting to get understanding what this whole industry of water, like you said, what got you interested in that. And more people I see are getting really, really involved in this stuff. And I see more universities and colleges offering more courses related to that. And I think that's kind of a good thing. I wish they would go back a little further and start some of this stuff in high school and to give people some more of a direction of what it all is.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that it's a really interesting field. I think it's, like you said, you know, near the beginning, we kind of run silent, run deep, and a lot of folks don't know what it is that we do. And yet what it is we do is, I think, very interesting. And there's a lot of careers in the water industry. In fact, there was a report just done a few months ago by the Brookings Institute that identified about 1.7 million people in this country are directly employed in the and with water in the water field, either constructing water facilities, designing water facilities, operating, managing, maintaining it in various trades. So we employ a lot of people, and there's a lot of different career and occupational choices there, from things like the trades, electricians, pipe fitters, plumbers. We need people like that. There aren't enough young people getting into the trades these days.
Yeah, there's, you know, so many variables involved. I think just getting young people, as you say, to come and look at the plant, your plant, for example, right? That can just spur the interest. I know you were talking about how you like to hike and where you grew up and all that sort of stuff. Similar backgrounds for Rob and I. I know you probably don't find that unusual, but both of us kind of got interested in the industry through that sort of level, you know, and I went and took some geology and botany and biology classes at college, and that's where I got my interest and started my career. And after 40 or so years, I'm still doing the same thing.
And here you are today on the show.
Yeah, here I am today.
Sorry, I had to leave for a second. I was sneezing and coughing, and I apologize if I interrupted anybody here. I didn't mean to do that. So what are some of the details and issues that you guys are starting with building water workforce and all? How do you go out and try to develop people, or do you?
Well, we have our member associations, which basically every state and provinces in Canada will have their own regional water environment association that's underneath the big umbrella of the Water Environment Federation. So it's really done on the local level that it's most effective. Getting into the universities, having the outreach into the schools, getting the young people to understand what's going on. One of the biggest pushes that we have now is we recognize that our workforce is aging. You know, with the baby boomers starting to get older in the next 10 years going to be retiring and out, it's going to leave a rather large vacuum and a void for talented, skilled people in the water industry. So we see an opportunity here to go towards groups that are underrepresented, that haven't been in the workforce in the past, folks like, you know, women. Women are really underrepresented. About 15% of the water workforce is women, compared to about 47% of all occupations across the country. So there is a group that we can really target. African-Americans, Asian, Latinos, the veterans, military veterans. So we have a push on now towards really targeting and getting information into these underrepresented groups. As a matter of fact, just a few months ago, we had our WEFTEC in a conference in New Orleans, and we started a new program we call the Inflow Program. And what we did is we reached out to students, engineering students, at historically black universities and colleges, Howard University in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. Tuskegee University, down in Alabama, University of South Florida. And we invited students and gave them scholarships, full paid way, with their transportation, lodging, and the registration of the conference paid by sponsors, to come to WEFTEC. We had 16 students come. And then we shepherded them around and had a nice program, because this conference is huge, like 22,000 people. You get lost pretty easily. So we had some young professionals who were there to show them around, take them to different events, and introduce them to different parts of the water sector, so they could see that there's all these exciting careers available in the water sector. And many of them never saw themselves working in water. They were in engineering careers, but they were thinking construction. That's where I'm going to end up in construction, which is nothing wrong with that.
No.
They just weren't even aware that there was this water. So now we have these folks who are excited, and they go back and tell their friends and their roommates. And these types of things, I believe it's really like the reach out to the one-on-one that's really going to make a difference.
Yeah. Do once they go into this or enter this career, do you, through your organization or any, I know AWWA has certification programs that people have to go through, and some states you have to have licenses to do certain things in treatment plants and things. Is that the same thing that they would have to go through?
Yes, depending on some of their careers, but yes, we have certified operators. And every state has their licensing for that, and WEF does provide training and education so that they can take the operator's exam. We have professional engineer licensing for those who go into engineering design.
Is that a standard? Is that a standard across the United States, or each state has their own? Is it different?
Each state has their own license, but there is reciprocity available, so that if you get a license in California, you could also get a license in, say, Nevada.
Oh, okay.
You know, with maybe some additional modules that have to be taken.
Okay.
But it's pretty much, you know, you can get the reciprocity.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I find a lot of people who never were subjected to any of this in college and didn't know about it. I believe a large amount of people would probably switch halfway through their studies to do more about water. It's like years ago, you know, or even today, hospitality business is really big. Nursing, for example, and hospitality for hotels is big industry. But, you know, the water thing, as you said, we need tons more people in this industry to worry about the health of the water and the treatment and all of that. I think that's going to be the next boom for the next 10 years. That's my prediction.
Oh, yeah. You know, think about this, Rob. The jobs that you don't want to be in are the ones that can be outsourced to another country.
Right.
So you can't outsource treating your POO.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Great point. You know, recruitment efforts that include outreach and education are just the things that open people's eyes. And I think once that young people or folks that are looking for a career, once they see what's available and it looks exciting to them and we make it exciting, that's when you get the up-and-comers that raise their hand and say, oh, I'm interested.
Yes, and there's many parts of, you know, like the three of us, we got interested in it by seeing water in its natural environment. And I think that is so important. You know, one of the things that drives me to do this every day is I think about, I have 10 nieces and nephews, and I want them to have the same experiences that I have. I want them to be able to go out into the woods and to see these clean streams and to see this this beautiful water environment, just like we had the opportunity to do.
Right.
But it's not going to come, you know, it's not just going to happen on its own. It is going to take that effort, because as our population grows, we make a greater and greater impact on our environment.
Yeah. Let's talk about a little, just for a second, resource recovery. Can you explain to our listeners what this means in the context of water?
Sure. Folks don't really think too much about this, because when they flush their toilet, it's a waste, which means get rid of it, dispose of it. But we stop thinking about wastewater as a waste product. And think of it now, we use the term used water or potential water, because all water is recycled. We all know about the water cycle, and water moves from one form to another. But there are also the constituents in there can be thought of as resources that can be harvested and reused. So what am I talking about? Well, primarily the ones that are in quantities that can be used most are phosphorus, and that comes from our urine and feces, and that can be recovered and reused as a fertilizer. And I don't know if you know this, but phosphorus is a non-renewable resource. It comes from mines in places like Jordan and Morocco and China. And we're running out of it. It's like if you don't have phosphorus, there is no life. Mm. So phosphorus is one. Nitrogen is another one. Nitrogen is very important for growing crops, and that's what made the big boom in agriculture in the early 1900s was the ability with the Haber-Bosch process to take atmospheric nitrogen and turn it into ammonia.
Right. Yeah.
So here we are. We have ammonia coming into our treatment plant. Yeah. So there's a potential. We have also coming in there the organic matter, and two things can happen to that organic matter, which is carbon-based.
Right.
That could end up back into the land, used as fertilizer, or it can be converted in some processes that we have and turned into methane gas. We call it biogas. It's a byproduct of one of our processes. Capture that and use that as a free energy source instead of using fossil fuel-based natural gas.
Yep. And, you know, algae is getting to be a big thing now and for biomass and stuff.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we're doing a research project at one of our treatment plants that I'm working on is in growing algae and using algae as a means for the uptake of phosphorus and nitrogen.
Right.
Then the algae can be harvested and used for multiple products, whether it be for fertilizer or it could be turned into a biosynthetic acid, bioplastic, biofuels. Number of things.
Well, there's lots of nutrients in that, and they you can get them in vitamins. You can get. They even use it in mayonnaise to make mayonnaise.
That's part I hadn't heard.
I learned that. We're going to have.
I
a
wish
guest.
You hadn't have told me that.
Oh, sorry. We're going to have a guest on in a couple of weeks who's going to talk about that. He's from the biomass organization. So it was interesting on that. Just real quick here, as we're moving close to the news hour here on funding for the water infrastructure. We hear about. You know, this funding goes from time to time and or this big gap. What's happening with that? Is that just in your area or all over?
Well, of course, this is on infrastructure, as we know, for all sorts of things, roads, bridges, airports, and so on. And WEF is leading an effort getting other water agencies to push Congress now. Now's the time that they're talking about an infrastructure bill, but they seem to be talking mainly surface infrastructure, meaning roads and bridges. Right. And we've got to get them to think about subsurface, the water mains, the sewage pipes, the wastewater treatment plants. Water reuse. So we are really pushing, and we want you folks and others to remind their congressmen that we've got to have that funding because that is the lifeblood of our country.
Oh, absolutely. We got pipes here that are over 100 years old that keep bursting, and there's going to be a lot of money that needs to be for infrastructure, and that's going to help the economy. But we got to spend a lot of money to do it. And
it's tremendous help to the economy. It's jobs, and a lot of money comes back into the economy as a result.
Right. Well, we're running up here against our NBC News Hour, but we can talk to you for a couple more hours, but I do appreciate you coming on the show, and I sure learned a lot today.
Well, great